Hello, I'm Bruce Celery. This is Moolala, Money Made Simple. How many monthly subscriptions are you paying for? Do you have any idea? Or have, like me, have you lost count? From streaming to delivery services, it can be really hard to keep track of them all. And suddenly your unwanted subscriptions are auto-renewing for another year. Leslie Ann Scorgi is a personal finance expert. She is the founder of MeVest, and she's going to take us through how to manage all those subscriptions. Now, speaking of monthly subscriptions, some financial advisors are now offering this model to their own customers. Sam Lichtman is co-founder of Achieve Wealth Management. He's one of them. He's going to talk about how this works. Then, calling all students. It can be really, really difficult and expensive to find a place to live when you head off to college or university. Now there are some home sharing platforms that match student renters with seniors. Seniors got an extra room in their house. One of those platforms is called Spaces Shared. Its co-founder and CEO, Rylan Kinnan, is here to talk about how it works. Plus, what's your money story? What's your money story? Sophie Howe is a certified money coach and the founder of Money Sophie. She is helping people write theirs, articulating the story from their past as a way to find some insight into what's affecting them in the present. This is Moolala, Money Made Simple, brought to you in part by Credit Canada, the first and longest standing nonprofit credit counseling agency in the country. Let's get started. Not everyone is open to talking about their personal finances, but how about writing about them? My next guest calls this your money story. Sophie Howe is a certified money coach and founder of Money Sophie. She started a workshop to teach people how to write their money story as a way to help improve their relationship with their finances. She joins us now from Hong Kong to talk about the process. Hello, Sophie.
Hello, Bruce. Thank you so much for having me today.
It is our pleasure. When you use the phrase your money story, what does it mean for you?
Yes, that's a good question. I use actually the word money story, but it's also known as money biography. And it's actually not from me. It's actually from a money coach called Deborah Price, who is also the founder of a money coaching institute based in the US. And it's where I'm certified money coach from. And it's actually an exercise where you write your money related memory from your first one, usually around 5 or 6 years old, every year to today. So regardless of your age today, so it can be quite long, maybe 10 to 60 pages, according to your writing skills and your age.
And what kind of things would people write about? I bet there's a whole spectrum from the very practical, like, I remember the first time I went to the store and bought my own Freezy, to something, you know, much more dramatic for someone who's experienced trauma.
Yes, correct. So actually you said very correctly in terms of there's a very wide range of type of money stories. It doesn't have to be directly related to money. Obviously, it's helpful. Like you say, if you're in the store and I don't know if you're paying something, that is something obvious. But you have to kind of stay open-minded about what can be related, such as like I've seen a lot of association. People think they were bad in math at school and then they associate like, oh, so that's why they're not good with finances today. So you can also think that, oh, there's no direct impact at that time. But so it's basically everything you can remember today in the past that have somehow can be connected to money maybe later in the future.
What is the purpose? Well, I mean, I think it sounds like a really interesting and an insight-rich exercise, but why would you tell people or recommend people do this?
Yes, and the purpose is actually to be able to connect the dots between your childhood stories, your money stories, and your current financial behaviors. Because actually, a lot of our financial behaviors today are kind of dictated by our money beliefs. And studies have shown that most of our money beliefs are formed before age 10. Mm. That's why exercise is so powerful to kind of uncover where are your money beliefs, and because some of them are very obvious, right? Oh, I don't like math. I mean, if this is one of them, and that's why I'm not good with my finances. But it can be everything from, I mean, recently I have helped a client who is both a shopaholic and a hoarder, and she actually earned decent money, but she spends all her paycheck in shopping, leaving like really no money to save or invest, or even her emergency fund. And by working on her money stories, she actually discovered that growing up, her parents were always absent, and she always have felt this abandonment. And she realized that they compensate the absence with gifts. They cover her with tons of expensive gifts. They would go in the mall together and they would buy her everything she wanted. So in a way, until she worked on her money story, she never realized that she subconsciously associated shopping with all these family good times. And most importantly, materials, belongings never abandoned her, as opposed to individuals.
Tell me a little bit about the workshop idea. So this is something that, you know, we could take really just the essence of the conversation that we've had, and people could go out and start clicking, clacking on a keyboard. You've decided to create this workshop. What additional support or insight or guidance does that structure provide?
Yes. So this workshop, it helps you to give you a different prompt, because as you say, it can be quite tricky and sometimes very challenging to write your money stories from your first memory. And sometimes people maybe have either blocked their memory or it's just hard to get started. So the workshop purpose was really to give them prompts and try different ways to think about your money stories. It's almost, if you have to write your autobiography, it can be very overwhelming. You don't know how to get started. So it's more like a framework to help them, like, oh, how to write a good money story. And it doesn't have to be complicated. And actually, I say, like, most of the money stories per age should be just between like 3 to maybe 7 lines. And it just have to be the experience described shortly and the emotion felt at that time. That is a perfect equation for a money story.
Is there a particular type of person for whom this approach resonates? I mean, I'm someone who has a box of diaries in my basement somewhere from my teen written angst of like all the things that went wrong in high school. Is that the type of person who would say, oh yeah, oh, that would be an interesting exercise? And others who've never engaged in diaries or journaling might have a harder time making the leap to see the benefit?
Yes. I mean, I'm very happy to hear that you have this diary and you had this habit. And I mean, I definitely think it's a great habit to connect with to be more aware. So I believe in writing. And but I can also sense that a lot of people might be intimidating, right? People who are not very used to writing. But I definitely think that everyone is a writer. It's just like a matter of practice. And I do, to answer your question about who is the target to, I mean, I'm obviously very biased, but I think everyone should do this exercise because it has helped me tremendously to uncover what's my deepest money belief. I used to be very bad with money, I mean, shamefully, with my money habits. And I earned money and I did a lot of financial education and I couldn't apply everything I learned until I kind of connect with my money beliefs and managed to change my money beliefs. So I invite everyone to write it, but I think the priority people are definitely people who will think money not as rationally. So for example, people who want to save or invest, but they don't do it. And we don't understand why. I mean, that is definitely the priority.
One of the things I've noticed in my writing practice, such as it is, and this is in large part, my mom was a journaler. She would go to a journal writing group every single week for decades. She did this. But one of the other benefits, in addition to insight, was it was almost an access to closure. I'd written it down, therefore it didn't spin around in my head like it did before I wrote it down. Have you seen that in participants who've embarked on this route?
Yes, definitely. Yes. Actually, this is a very good way to put it. Yes, I think there are a lot of people, first of all, they are not aware. So this exercise helped them to raise awareness about this. And second one, yes, to close, to have a closure. to whatever happened, because unfortunately, a lot of people have obviously some sort of trauma related to money when they were younger. And I mean, when I say trauma, it can be big or small ones, and it definitely helps to let it go and to forgive either themselves or the people and to have a proper closure.
Mm. You live in Hong Kong. You are from France. What do you think varies by culture? And what do you think about one's money story is universal to being human?
Oh, yes, that's a very good question. And I definitely think that money is very cultural, even though I would say with confidence, but in many cultures is taboo money, but it's actually very different because in a place like Hong Kong, where it's very strong capitalist city, country, and it's even though people are more open to say that they like money, they don't have this taboo thing, but at the same time, people who are not good with money, they're even more ashamed versus people maybe in Europe or in North America, where people will not maybe openly say that they like money or they do everything about money. And so in a way, they have less taboo about like not being good with money. So I think every cultures have their own taboo in terms of money, but they actually express in a different way.
Mm. We've talked about the past. So looking really, really back as far as you can remember and articulating examples of how money has featured in your life. And then you look at the analysis and like, wow, what are the patterns? What do I see? How does writing your money story enable you to write your story for the future?
I think it goes back to being aware because as I say, a lot of people, I mean, when you see the statistic, it's kind of crazy to see that 50% of people live paycheck to paycheck, even though they earn more than $100,000 a year. And beyond that, I mean, a lot of people still don't either invest or save or just prepare for the financial future. So, and we can tell that even just like money alone or more financial education alone doesn't actually help them to make healthy financial behaviors. And by working on their money stories, they can actually bring awareness and understand what are their roadblocks. Because as I say, everyone has a different one. I give a few examples earlier, but there are so many different ones. People associate money with greed or money with evil. Mm. There's a reason why people are not good with money, or maybe because they think, oh, their parents were there very successful, so they will never reach that level of success. On the opposite, the parents come from a poor background, so they think like it's almost genetic and they will never be able to achieve it. So everyone has their own story. So all the money stories are unique. Even if you come from the same family, you have the same education and your siblings, you have a unique money story. My money story is so different from my brothers. I have two brothers. So it's so unique. And unless you understand what happening to your past, how you have associated money your whole life, it's very unlikely that you can change your financial behaviors. Mm.
I had this assignment from a coach once many years ago who told me to write a letter to myself from the future, describing the future. And it was a transformative exercise because it allowed me to write the story and to have life be an act of creation versus something that was a function of external variables. And as you're speaking, I hear that as an opportunity in what you're saying, that people can have agency to write the story that is reflective of what they're committed to and what their values are.
Yes. This visionary exercise is definitely very good. I also invite my clients to do it after the money story. So usually I like into the past first, and then we build the future together in terms of like visualize it, and writing it is definitely one of the good method to do it. And the more you can give details, either for the smell, maybe the visuals, the details of the future, the better you actually will have more likelihood to implement everything to achieve your future.
Really inspiring stuff. Sophie, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me, Bruce.
Sophie Howe is a certified money coach and founder of Money Sophie, Sophy. She's really dialed in to this whole idea of money story, and it's a fascinating, fascinating topic. She was in Hong Kong. Coming up next on Moolala.
looking for an affordable place to rent as a student, whew, that could be a challenge. Home sharing platform Spaces Shared matches student renters with seniors who have some extra room. Co-founder and CEO Rylan Kinnon will tell us how it works. And later, losing track of all those subscriptions you pay for, that's a thing. Leslie Ann Skorky, personal finance expert and founder of MeVest, will share some tips on managing all those monthly costs. If you have missed an episode of Moolala, you can catch up in two ways. One, you can go to moolala.ca, and there you'll find episodes by name, by topic. You can look at the segments, or you can go to the podcast platforms directly. Spotify, Amazon Prime, Apple Music, whatever, wherever you listen to your podcasts, you can download the full show or segments, write a review, and bonus points, you can subscribe to the next episode so it will arrive right on your device. Unlike the fee for, you know, I don't know, Netflix or Razor delivery, subscribing to receive this podcast is exactly $0.00.
You're listening to Moolala, Money Made Simple, with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
Welcome back. Moolala, Money Made Simple is brought to you in part by Credit Canada. I am the CEO of the organization, and we are Canada's longest standing nonprofit credit counseling agency. Our mission is to help people get out of debt so they can get back into life. Listen, debt is a brutal reality for millions of Canadians. It starts to pile on for lots and lots of different reasons: job loss, divorce, illness, bad luck, you name it. Our accredited credit counselors are available to help you understand your current financial situation and take you through all your options on how to move forward. And there really are options out there. So go to creditcanada.com. We are nonprofit. As I said, the counseling is free and judgment free. Finding a space to rent when you're a student can be really, really difficult. We know that demand for housing anywhere is really, really high. And we know that in all likelihood, your student budget is likely really, really low. Now, there are a number of different platforms out there that are trying to make this a little bit easier and tap into what I would call underutilized capacity. One of them is called Spaces Shared, and it is a home sharing platform that pairs up students to live with seniors in, you know, a spare bedroom or something that they might have to earn a little bit extra cash. To talk about this idea, we are joined by the co-founder and CEO of Spaces Shared. His name is Rylan Kinnon, and he's in Toronto. Hello there.
Hello, Bruce. Thanks for having me today.
Where did this idea come from? Because on the one hand, it's complete genius. And of course, why didn't we do this decades ago? But it wasn't around, or at least at scale, a couple of years ago.
So I was doing some work for an advocacy organization in Ontario focused on student mental health. And in that work, I spoke with student leaders from across the province, and three key things stood out. Every student leader from every community that I spoke to, didn't matter where they were in Ontario, had housing as a top priority. Second piece is, a student leader said very eloquently, you know, when we think about mental health, we tend to think about therapeutic interventions, but the reality is you can't counsel me out of food, economic, or housing insecurity. The final piece, as you said in your opening, Bruce, is just how limited some students' budgets are. Some of the international students that are coming to Canada have housing budgets as low as $500 a month. So I started to think, what in the world can you do? If housing is unaffordable for middle-income families, which it is becoming increasingly unaffordable, you know it's hard for everybody else. So I remember reading about models that match students and seniors and decided there's got to be a way to scale those models, just as you said, Bruce.
So how does this work? How does it work?
So we've built an end-to-end platform that allows you to create a listing as an older adult, match to students who meet your requirements, communicate with them in the platform by message, and then meet by video chat. And then based on that meeting, if you enjoy each other, you can set up a home share agreement, again, automated through the platform, and finally set up payments in the platform. Then we check in. So we check in the day the student moves in, a week thereafter, and every month. And if there's any issue that comes up, either from the host or the student side, we're there to help.
What would that help look like? Would you pull the senior aside and say, you got to tone down that hip hop music because your student does not like that?
So it could be something like that. One of the things we know, one of the things we always say is pretty much everyone has had an arrangement where they've lived with someone else, a partner, a spouse, a girlfriend, a boyfriend, a roommate. And you can probably think of an example of a small thing that became a big issue because you did not address it early. So we want to be there to help folks address these issues early that they come up. And when someone says, like, if their score on their survey that we send them changes even just a tiny bit, we're going to follow up because we know that's the start of that small issue that could become a major problem.
And what are some of the things that you've noticed? I mean, you've now got data. What are the things that you've noticed are the little bit of rah, 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 in those relationships? Is it because someone's loading the dishwasher wrong? Because that's the first thing I would think of.
So everybody has a thing like that. Like my wife would tell you that I load the dishwasher wrong
too.
I'm not even sure what the right way of doing it is.
There's a right way. She knows. You got to ask her. She'll tell you.
I've got to ask her. And you know what? She needs to provide me with a written manual so I can do it
properly. And photos.
We can stop having the discussion. And photos and maybe an explanatory video as well. So one of the things we've heard repeatedly is, what does a full garbage can look like? We know that this is one of the things that can cause match breakdown. Because you might say, okay, the student's responsible for taking the garbage out when it's full, but the student doesn't see it as full. And the host sees it as full.
Right. And they're like, I need to yank it out and jam my foot into it and compress it.
Exactly. Exactly. Like I'm just using a all natural compressor of my foot as though we had a garbage compactor. That's not fine.
Genius. Genius. Now, my mom had people live with her for decades, mostly theater
Amazing.
People, because we had the theater connection. So there'd be actors and stage managers. And she loved it. She loved it. Not everyone would love it. If you're the senior offering housing, how do you determine if this is for you?
So the first thing we'd say to a senior who's thinking about it is, first of all, you have to be open to new experiences. That's the absolute first thing. You have to have a level of empathy to be able to put yourself in the position that the student's in. So that if you know the student is not as on top of their game one day as you might expect, that you can say, okay, I get it because it's midterms or it's whatever else. And obviously a desire to live with other people. If you're extremely introverted and the thought of going down before you've made your morning coffee and someone talking to you terrifies you, maybe it's not for you. Though, we might be able to help you find a similarly introverted person who would never want to talk to you without knowing that there's caffeine flowing through your veins. So, but the key things are openness to new experiences, empathy, and feeling comfortable with the idea of someone in their home. But I will say, Bruce, and we always say this, you might think it's not for you, but you might actually enjoy it.
Yeah.
So what we always say is you can rent for as little as 1 month. That could be for someone who's doing a co-op placement or a work term. Try it out. It might surprise you.
Yeah. I'm that way about cats. I hate cats. And then we got a cat. And now I love my cat. My cat's the best. I can't imagine life without a cat.
Exactly.
I want to ask about the motivation on the part of the senior. And I'm sure, you know, people may have both in equal measure, or sometimes it skews one way or the other. The companionship benefit and the financial benefit. What have you learned so far in terms of the number one reason why people might do this? Seniors.
So there's a third reason that I'll add in, which has been exactly what I hoped for, which is a lot of older adults have said, I understand it is hard for students and I want to give back.
Okay.
Older adults are actually responding and saying, I get it. It's hard. I don't believe any student should be struggling to find safe and affordable housing. So I'm going to do it. But they might also say, typically it's multiple. Some might say, you know, if I had to put the number one reason, it's probably income, but it's closely followed by companionship. Mm. Others have said, I'm doing this because the student needs it. I don't actually need the money. I'm going to donate the money. That's the situation of one of our hosts is in.
And then what about for the renter? I mean, for sure, there's a real compelling case to be made that you've got a safe bed in a home, but some students might think, that senior's going to cramp my style. I don't want to walk into a home that smells like mothballs and lavender.
What's been amazing is hearing from students that, and this is what we hoped for, this is what I dreamed of when we designed this program, was that we're going to build meaningful relationships and relationships that are also an opportunity for knowledge transfer and mentorship. The reality is we can match a student who's studying engineering with an active or retired engineer. We can match a student who's studying nursing with an active or retired nurse. Suddenly that person is a source of knowledge and potentially also a node on that student's network. It's not for every student. I think we can all think of student populations that, especially in their first year, they're looking to have a good time. They're looking to socialize, they're looking to live with other young people. But there are plenty of students who are looking for stable, safe, affordable housing and understand the value and the knowledge and the wisdom and experience that can be shared living with an older adult.
How do these rooms get priced?
So it's up to the hosts currently to set the price. We don't set a limit. What we do have is a helper's discount, which is where the host can ask for up to 5 hours of help around the house per week. And we reduce the rent by 5% monthly for every hour they're looking for on a weekly basis. Wow. That's the only thing we have set. It is a defined list of tasks, none of which are care tasks. It's things like getting groceries, cooking a meal, light household cleaning, snow removal, those types of things. But otherwise, it's up to the host to set the rent.
I am sure, you know, we only have a limited amount of time, but people have lots and lots of questions. What are two or three other things that you get asked all the time that you can answer en masse as a part of this discussion?
I really appreciate that question. The first thing is, how do I feel safe opening my home to a stranger? And the first thing we say is, you've met them, you've contacted them as many times as you want to before you've decided to meet them. They're not a stranger by the time they move in. And the other thing is, we have verified that student's identity before they've been allowed to reach out to you. We've also verified that that student has been accepted and enrolled at a post-secondary institution. And if the student has been in Canada or is a domestic student for more than a year, they run a criminal background check. So all of those things happen before the student moves in. They also know that we're not going away. We're going to keep checking in. There's a phone number they can call if issues come up. So that, I think, is probably the most important piece, is this is not a stranger coming into your home. This is not a random person. Vetting has been involved. And you've also gotten to say what you're looking for. And we've matched you to someone who meets those requirements.
There are some seniors offering housing who would have rules that might live in the land of values or even morality. So that would be things like having a partner, boyfriend or girlfriend, stay over. It might be the consumption of alcohol and drugs, for example. How do you ensure, or at least up the probability, that there is going to be a fit on some of those maybe less tangible things?
We ask the question right up front. So we ask expectations from the host and from the student about alcohol, tobacco, and cannabis consumption. It can be as liberal as you can smoke it, drink it whenever you want to, never. We also ask about daytime and evening guests and overnight guests. So some hosts say there's no overnight guests, period, end of story. So all of that is covered right up front. And obviously, there are matches basically for everyone, but some students might look at that home and say, no, that's too restrictive. Others will say, that's fully in keeping with how I live my life, and I'm totally happy to live in that environment. The key thing is, it's very clear right up front what the host is expecting and what the students expect.
How many of your, and this is just a ballpark, how many of your seniors would open up more than one room? Or is really the design here for them to have a plus one versus a plus two or three?
So I'm trying to think, looking at it right now, it's a pretty small percentage, maybe 5% have opened up more than one room. And what we tell people is, try this out, see if you like it, and improve the chances of success. So if you have multiple rooms, maybe don't rent them all out the first time you open your home up. Try with one student, see what that's like, and then think about what it's going to be like to add another person into that context. Is that going to be a benefit? Is that going to be a drawback? So we're not going to stop you from listing multiple rooms if you are living in the home. You must live in the home. This is not for absentee landlords. But we tend to recommend start with one, see how it goes, and then grow it from there.
Clearly, you have a social mission here. This isn't just, you know, the Airbnb for students. So looking ahead 5 to 10 years, what's your grand ambition that will have you look back and say, this was a total home run?
Oh, there's a few things I would put into that answer, and it's a great question. First of all, I'd like to see students that are happy and healthy and well integrated into the economies and the cities that they live in, both during school and upon graduation, particularly for international students. I'd also like to see more people that have an excess of room in their home, multiple empty bedrooms, thinking about how they could open them up. And we're focused on students and seniors right now, but there's lots of people that have lots of need and there's lots of bedrooms. And I'd like to believe that people would open their homes to folks in need if they felt confident that we've done a really good job vetting those people and that we are there if an issue comes up. So in 5 to 10 years, I would love people to think about their homes as a way of giving back, as a way of also getting assistance, additional income, that is also a way to commit, to contribute to a society that has a housing crisis, and a way for them to actually be part of the solution to that crisis.
That's great. Rylan, thank you for your time, most obviously, but really more than that, thank you for your vision. I expected we were going to have like a pretty run of the mill, like, oh, how does that work? But I'm finishing this conversation wishing I had an extra room in my house. Maybe I could kick out my kid and then rent it on your platform. Can I do that? They're 13. They're 13. They could live
in the
garage.
You may have to wait a little bit longer how I understand the child protection laws, but
fine.
But thanks, Bruce. I appreciate the opportunity. And what I will say is you probably have neighbors and friends that have empty bedrooms. Yeah. Tell them about Spaces Shared, please.
That's great. Rylan Kinnon is the founder of Spaces Shared. It's a really interesting idea that brings together seniors and students in a way that delivers multifaceted benefits.
Hi, it's me, your dad. Look, we need to talk. This isn't working. The missed payments, the collection calls, and all those sleepless nights. We need nonprofit debt counseling, and I found the perfect place. Credit Canada Debt Solutions. They're non-judgmental, 100% confidential. They'll negotiate with creditors and even stop interest. Don't you want to rebuild your credit? You deserve better.
Break up with debt. Visit creditcanada.com.
Coming up later, personal finance expert Leslie Ann Scorgi is here to share her tips for managing some of your unwanted subscriptions that maybe you're paying for and totally forgot about. But first, one monthly subscription that some people are choosing to pay for. It is a subscription for financial advice. Sam Lightman is co-founder of Achieve Wealth Management. He offers this service, and we're going to talk about why and how it works. I'm the money columnist for Cityline. It is a daily lifestyle show on air across North America. And I've got lots of tips and tricks and things to talk about when it comes to earning money, spending it wisely, slashing debt, investing, talking about money with your family. You can check out those segments online at cityline.tv, then search for me.
You're listening to Moolah La, Money Made Simple, with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
You can pay for almost anything on a monthly subscription these days. Streaming services, of course, for movies and music and website hosting. You can even have a subscription for cat food and razors. Turns out you can actually now pay a monthly subscription fee for financial advice. What? Yeah. It is not as popular here in Canada as it is in the US, for example, but some planners and advisors are offering this comp model to their clients. And our next guest is one of them. Sam Lightman is co-founder of Achieve Wealth Management. He's here now to tell us how it works and what some of the pros and cons are of this particular setup. Hello there.
Hi, Bruce. Thanks so much for having me.
Why did you decide to start offering a subscription model to your clients?
I noticed there was a gap in the market when clients that needed financial advice would get turned away from CFPs simply because they didn't have enough money to invest. Therefore, the fees that their business would generate wouldn't be enough to pay for the services of a CFP at a traditional firm. And looking down at the States has always been a big driver of how I've run my practice, and seeing how they are operating with individuals in very creative ways to help service clients and to help give them the financial advice that they need. I looked down at the States and saw, okay, well, they're doing this already. Why can't we do it up here? And so we had the conversation with our dealer and got the approval to go ahead and do it. And clients love it. it's a really cool model where, you know, they don't have to invest anything with a financial planner to get good qualified financial advice.
So tell me how it works.
So typically what happens is clients who are in the higher income earners, but are just starting out, right? They've graduated university, or they have student debt or debt of any kind that they want to focus on paying down and don't have a lot of money to invest. They'll typically get turned away by the traditional institution. And so the way it works is they come in and we build out a financial plan. And then we have quarterly meetings, in some cases monthly meetings, depending on the need of the client, but quarterly meetings to ensure implementation of the plan. And in the meantime, clients can call in and say, hey, Sam, something's come up. We need to talk. I've changed a job. We're expecting things are, you know, changing. So we need to update the plan. But minimum, we update it quarterly. And clients have all the privileges that they would have if they were also an investment client with my firm.
Now, Netflix, I don't know, what is it, $23.99 these days? I don't know. It's some number like that. What is a subscription for financial advice? How much does that cost?
So it ranges from, depending on the services offered. Sometimes people will only offer money coaching, budgeting, and those types of things. And those can be, you know, quite low in cost if it's mostly automated and not as high touch. The services that I have start at $199 a month and can go up from there depending on what the client needs. If they're a business owner, if their situation's relatively simple, those types of things. But we start at the $199 a month.
Now, people are more familiar with the three basic fee models out there because a lot of us have been banging on about them for a couple of years. So there is commission-based, where you buy a mutual fund and your advisor gets a commission. There is fee-based, where it's like, say, 1% on your total assets under management. And then there's fee-only, where you're paying an amount kind of like you're paying an accountant to do your taxes. This, to me, based on how you've described it, sounds like a fee-only model divided by 12. Right or wrong?
I would say that it has that component, and not entirely, though. In some cases, when clients need an in-depth financial plan up front before we can work on any implementation or continued servicing, we do still charge an upfront planning fee. And so typically the cases that I've run into where this is really helpful, though, is cases where people are bringing in quite a bit of money, but don't necessarily know how to best allocate it. And so when we're going through, especially sometimes with people who need the monthly meetings, we go through like, listen, how did your last month go, right? What did you spend your money on? We do some behavioral coaching around cash flow and budgeting. And those types of things can be really, really helpful for people who find themselves not able to save, even though they're good income earners. And I think lots of us may be going through that right now. So it's not necessarily just a planning fee divided by 12. In some cases, it's turned into that, but it's not always the case.
How do you ensure that you don't underprice? Because I can imagine there's a huge difference in what clients need from you. There's some who are like, I don't even know. It's no, you know, I'm not calling, you know, twice a day. And other clients who need a tremendous amount of handholding, either because of their circumstances or because of their temperament.
We try to flush that out in the first few months of working together. None of these clients are under contract to be here for a year or anything like that. So what we do is we establish a level of service expectations, and we go in and say, listen, like, okay, here's your situation. Here's what you've done in the past. What do you need to do going forward? Does this require monthly or quarterly servicing structure? And based on what it requires, we'll go from there. If we find out that it's not sufficient or the client's needing a lot more, I guess we'll call it handholding than we expected initially, then we'll go back to the client and we'll say, listen, I'll go back to the client and say, listen, like, we should probably look at changing our structure. This is how we've, you know, priced this in the past, but we're obviously needing a lot more of a high touch nature. Or sometimes we get the opposite, right? Where clients don't book that monthly meeting or quarterly meeting, and we've really got to follow up on that because we don't want to make sure clients are paying for something they're not receiving. And that's the other side of it too. So it goes both ways a little bit. I don't think underpricing is necessarily, or overpricing right now. It's looking at, you know, what do clients think is fair? What's fair for me to spend my time on this? and going from there. And that'll change probably on an annual basis.
Who is the ideal client, would you say? How would you describe them both demographically and psychographically?
Well, I think that depends on the planner that you're asking. I love working with
millennials. I'm asking you, so you tell me.
Yeah, I love working with millennials. I love working with people who are motivated, career-driven, and who want to build wealth, but also understand that, you know, the pathway to building wealth is through the occupation that they've chosen and offloading the areas where they may... that need to be offloaded to experts like legal, accounting, and in my opinion, financial planning as well. So those are my ideal clients. People ages about, 29 to 42 right now, and career motivated individuals.
There has been real strides on fee transparency over the course of the last, 5 to 7 years or so. What should people know about other fees that might be relevant here? So you've got the $200 a month for as the subscription. If you were selling the mutual funds, for example, there'd also be a management expense ratio on those
right.
funds. Tell us about how those other costs are factored in.
If a client's on a subscription model, they do not invest their money with my firm. So we have, obviously, when we go through other funds that they may be holding, like if they're self-directing their money or if they work with another financial advisor, we like can give an opinion if they were to self-direct in those types of things. We try to stay away from recommending specific funds if they're not actually investing the money with my firm. But there's great solutions out there for DIYers that are very simple. There is no additional fees when clients pay subscriptions. If for some reason we determine that they need insurance, life insurance or critical illness or something like that, which my firm is licensed to do, what we'll do is we'll take the value of the commission that we make and credit that towards the planning fees. So it's all make sure that we're being transparent about that.
I understand the consumer need here. It makes perfect sense to me. What is harder to wrap my mind around is your interest in pursuing this, given that the way financial advisors make the biggest amount of money is they go for the big fish, and they, whether they're commission-based at 2.3% or fee-based at 1%, they need the biggest bucket of money, and then the percentage fee just kind of comes from that. Why would you pursue smaller fish?
I don't look at it like small fish versus big fish, although obviously from an economic standpoint, we have to make sure that the practice is sustainable. I look at it as, what investment am I making in a client today, and what's that return going to get me in 10 years from now? I'm young. I can play the long game in this industry. We're working with people I'm working with people right now who have high growth potential. So the reason why I'm choosing to do this right now is to invest my time and nurture the relationships with the people that I know are going to continue to grow with my practice. And it makes a lot of business sense to do it when we look at the 10-year trajectory, especially being very selective on the clients that I do choose to work with. We are working with clients that are going to be high earning clients, that are going to be clients that value advice. And because it doesn't necessarily make sense to do the investment model now, for a lot of these people, they're getting just garbage advice from sources that, I think the stats are like 70 to 80% of people are getting their advice from social media. Now, I'm very active on social media from financial literacy perspective, and that's how I get a lot of clients. But at the end of the day, there's not a lot of regulated advisors on these platforms. So they're turning to places that are unregulated or places that are not as highly trained to give good advice to people, but they need it. And so for me, this makes a lot of sense because these clients will grow over time.
Really interesting stuff. Sam, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me, Bruce.
Sam Lightman is with Achieve Wealth Management, and he was here to talk about a subscription model for financial advice. Now, we talked about this subscription you could add. Coming up, we're going to talk about ones you could subtract, especially ones you may have forgotten about, but still pay for. Personal finance expert Leslie Ann Scorgi of MeVest is here to share some of her tips to save some money, and keep track of all of those subscriptions. To stay up to date with all things Moolala, you can sign up for our newsletter. I guess technically it's a subscription, but it's free. And you can just unsubscribe at any time at the bottom of the newsletter if you don't want to get it anymore. It's a monthly thing. It talks about this show on SiriusXM, talks about CBC Radio, CityLine, BNN, Bloomberg, other interesting stuff that has crossed our radar. Go to Raider. How do you? Radar, not Raider. Just go to moolala.ca and you'll find the info about the newsletter there.
You're listening to Moolala, Money Made Simple with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, SiriusXM 167.
I think we live in a world of subscriptions now. It's almost like you can have subscriptions for meals, you can have subscriptions for entertainment, you can have subscriptions for clothing. They're everywhere. And it's great. It can make life super convenient. Sometimes it's great value, but it's pretty easy to lose track of all the things that you've signed up for and are paying for over the course of the month. Sometimes they auto-renew and you're not on top of it, and then it can be a big sum. We're going to talk about that opportunity and that challenge when it comes to managing your personal finances. Leslie Ann Scorgi is a personal finance expert. She is the founder of MeVest, and she is here to share some of her tips. Hello, Leslie Ann.
Hello, Bruce. What a topic.
Do you have any idea? Do you have any idea how many subscriptions you have? Like, how many do you think you have?
So because I knew we were talking about that today, I did a count myself, and I've got about 7 things that I subscribe to, which I thought was remarkably low, because during the pandemic, I was for sure double that amount of subscriptions. And I think, like, heaven help you if you are an ambitious person and you sign up for things, right? Like Calm, maybe you're doing like your meditation subscription, or you're like a parent, right? So you're signed up for Lulu Kids so that your kids can be self-entertaining or whatever. These things are just, they're like super small. And then when you layer them all on, they can be, now hold on to your seat, I don't want you to fall off.
Okay,
like,
I'm ready.
They can be anywhere from like $100 to $200 is kind of the range that we're seeing. And it was worse during the pandemic.
Yeah.
Much worse.
Yeah. And that's a month. That's a month. So over the course of a year, like, that could be thousands of dollars over the course of the year. And I think we'll get a lot of head nods to that, where people are like, I know I have a lot, but I don't know how many I have. And I certainly don't know how much they cost me. So how does one keep track of those, or at least do an inventory so that you're clear on what you're paying? And if you love the thing, like, I am not getting rid of Netflix. I love the Netflix. The kid loves the Netflix. We're keeping the Netflix. There are other subscriptions that maybe we don't need.
100%. So I recommend that when you do, I call it like an inventory system. And BT dubs, like, this is probably something you should do on the regular, at least every 6 months, just for everything to do with your costs, right? But like, focused on subscriptions, what you do is you just make a list. And the way you make the list is you dig into your accounts. So subscriptions are sneaky. They're usually like $3, $5, $14, and they show up, if you're like me, on different cards and in different ways. So you kind of need to do a bit of a sweep. And my advice, because this is the way my brain works, is I like to use a Google sheet and I put the name of whatever I'm paying for. So we are also a Netflix family, and how much it costs. And then I make a list. And it is the case, certainly in my household, that we have auto renew on for everything. And so I have to, if I want something to stop auto renewing, I have to make myself a calendar invite. And I have these, I have like 2 of them coming up, by the way.
Right.
I've got 2 calendar invites to cancel certain things. And it's just about like actually digging in and looking to see what is hitting the accounts. If you don't do the work, you will never find these little tiny subscriptions.
What are the criteria by which you would determine if you keep that subscription active? And one that I will eliminate off the top is your resignation and laziness, not yours, but I mean, a human's resignation and laziness about subscriptions. If you were to be actively triaging those subscriptions, how would you make those choices?
Okay, so I go with, like, am I using this on the regular and is it adding value to my life? So I mentioned, like, meditation apps, and I know they're super popular right now. I actually think if it keeps you well, do consider keeping that. If it's something that isn't being used and doesn't help add value to your life or keep you well or keep you feeling good, those are the quick wins, the things that you want to get off your credit card quickly. Also, if you've maybe outgrown something, so maybe it was useful for a time. And I think of all of the people who signed up for, you know, diet or weight loss programs, and maybe you've already achieved your goal, or like a sleeping program, you've achieved your goal.
Or more likely, you've given up on the goal. Come on, Leslie Ann. You've given up,
right?
Who's kidding who?
Well, so there's that too. But I think it's very much like, if you're using it and you love it, you keep it. Now, here's the other thing is, maybe there's an alternative. So it could be time for a change, or maybe you need to switch your package. If, like, let's face it, times are pretty tight for a lot of people right now. And you could just, like, I don't know, downsize, like, whatever you signed up for. Maybe you're not doing the elite package, but you're doing, like, the basic growth package or whatever they've named it.
You and I both have kids. One of my most frustrating experiences as it relates to subscriptions was trying to find where my kid had signed up for this Minecraft subscription. It took me, I am not kidding, 6 months to find how to cancel this thing, because I couldn't find the, I knew it was connected to my credit card, but I couldn't find where the subscription had actually occurred. And there was no help to be found online. What advice do you have for the cancellation of subscriptions that the sellers of those subscriptions are intending that we never cancel?
Like, are you talking about the rabbit hole that you go down where you're looking,
yes,
where did I sign up for this? It's like, I know it's there. I cannot find how it's, like, embedded deep in some kind of, like, vortex. I know what you're talking about. You can't figure out how to cancel it. So, I mean, this is really about, you got to go down the rabbit hole, especially if it's something you've signed up for your kids. I've had the same issue, and it's a recurring subscription, and I literally have to go through, like, 4 different windows to find out what I signed up for originally. My advice here is go down the rabbit hole. No, like, there's no way that they're going to make it easy for you to cancel on one screen. Why would you? As a reseller of anything, as a primary seller of anything, you want people to stay and to renew. And so you are going to put up roadblocks and barriers wherever you can. So go down the rabbit hole. Like with most things in life, if you do the work and you roll up your sleeves, you can find opportunities. It's like with anything in your budget, you got to dig in order to find what you're dealing with. And then you can make the change. It's not going to be helpful if you're like, I'm going to cancel that, I'm going to find it, but you never actually go in to do, like, go into your apps and go down the rabbit hole.
You know, it's funny, the legislation around newsletter subscriptions is super, makes it super simple. You, on the bottom of the newsletter, it says unsubscribe, and for the most part, you're good.
Right?
When it comes to subscriptions, I swear there's no legislation, because there are some things that I find it virtually impossible to cancel. If I could snap my fingers, there'd be a change in the regulatory framework, so it wasn't so hard.
Yep. I have, you know, I've found that is a bit of a gap as well. It's like consumer protection on this should now encompass digital subscriptions, that it's like it hasn't caught up yet. And I don't think anybody anticipated subscriptions would take off maybe to the magnitude that they have, but this is the way business is done now. And it's done this way because businesses are more profitable to have subscriptions. Yeah. So they're moving people off of one-time models and into the subscribe, and I call it the subscribe and forget model. But it's the way of the future. So we do want to advocate for your self audit for sure. So you're doing this every 6 months at a minimum. And then as we're talking to people, you know what? Folks, from different levels of the government, they live on my block. I'm often like telling them my thoughts. I can't help myself because now, I think it's important.
In the US, there are apps that they're like subscription manager apps, and they will scrape your bank account and bring all the information to you and enable you to cancel more frequently. As far as I can tell, there isn't one that operates here in Canada, but tell us a bit more about that idea and what's your feeling like. If there was one here, would you sign up for it? Or I have a hesitancy about allowing apps to scrape my bank accounts.
You know, I think it's like personal preferences on privacy. I'm kind of with you. Like, I don't like having eyes on my private information if I don't need them there. Like, if it's something that I can do myself. But you think of some maybe Canadian parallels. They're not exactly the same because we don't really have that same subscription management offering here in Canada. But a parallel to it would be something like Mint or You Need a Budget, where they're digging into your banking information, pulling in that information and summarizing it in helpful ways so you can see the categories of how you're spending. So if you're using one of those tools, my advice is go and look at the data, go and look how it's rolling together subscriptions and then dig in. So we have like some alternatives. I just think it's probably in a bit of a blend, right? So you can use technology to help you track, you can download your transactions, but you yourself have to do the hard work. Like we just said, you got to roll up your sleeves. You got to go find the cancellation portal. You have to be the person that's aware. Otherwise you'll end up, you know, with many, many subscriptions. I'm going to tell you, like I had a student not too long ago who like was completely surprised that she had $350 a month in subscriptions. And it had just been like tiny little layers of things, and they built up and wow.
It is time for some subscription subtraction. Leslie Ann. Good, eh? I know I was saving that right to the very end. I know. It's good. Leslie Ann, thank you for your time and for your insight. We really appreciate it.
Thanks, Bruce.
Leslie Ann Scorgi is the founder of MeVest, and she joined me to talk about subscriptions. I mean, sure, they are delightful, but boy, can that dollar amount add up. That is our show for today. A big thanks to our sponsors, Credit Canada, the first and longest standing nonprofit credit counseling agency in the country, for an easy way to get a hold of us. Email, old school email, invented decades ago. ask@moolala.ca is our email address. You can send us your comments, your questions, your story ideas, your feedback, the subscription that you chose to cancel today. You can also subscribe to our newsletter at moolala.ca, and we send out a newsletter once a month with things going on here on Sirius XM and CBC and CityLine and all those other places. On social media, I am at Bruce Celery on X. It still feels so weird to say that, but really it's Twitter. And Bruce Celery Moolala on Facebook. Thanks for listening and have a great day.